by the U.S. Central Command and at the Pentagon. The U.S. aims to ensure that Israel's bombing raids don't interfere with the U.S.-led military campaign in Syria. Many observers believe that the revelation by the Wall Street Journal was rather a confirmation of an open secret policy.
I think, first of all, whenever anyone says that the U.S. is secretly doing this or that with Israel, it's almost naive to say that. Israel is, in essence, an agent of the United States. I know there are people that think it works the other way around. But Israel is a Euro-American white settler state that was imposed on Palestine, as people know. Project beginning, I guess, perhaps you say, from the Balfour Declaration in the 20s forward to when the State of Israel, quote unquote, was created. And it's been a military base, basically, from which to secure the oil fields of the area, Iran's, Iraq's, all of it, Syria's, everywhere. The Israeli military, for all of its public relations effort to the contrary, is an agent of the U.S. military, with some nominal French and British input into that. Certainly financial input is not nominal, it's real. But this is a creature of the Pentagon and Langley that behaves in coordination with the policy that is implemented by the United States.
The timing of the Wall Street Journal revelation comes as the Israeli regime has increased its attacks against Syria. Last week, the regime heavily struck Damascus International Airport, which is still not completely up and running. Syrian officials have said on many occasions that U.S. troops in Syria are there to loot the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was not embarrassed to frankly say that he kept U.S. troops in Syria for Syrian oil only.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and
the fight against Daesh seems to have been a good pretext to maintain U.S. illegal presence in Syria. Syrian officials have also repeatedly called on the United Nations to stop Israel's strikes on the country. But those calls have almost always gone unnoticed behind a couple of verbal admonitions by UN officials. This seems to have emboldened the regime to carry on its attacks with impunity.
After setting loose Daesh and Al-Qaeda and 47 other varieties of jihadi on Syria, the U.S. government found itself facing a request from the Syrian government that had, by the way, been twice elected since 2011 by vast majorities of Syrians inside and outside the country. Israel is, you know, a U.S. lapdog. That has lots of advanced weapons. It's a money laundry for money that goes funneled through the Pentagon and Langley. Billions and billions of dollars of money taken from American taxpayers ends up in the hands of arms merchants, all kinds of people through Israel and whatever. And these things are used to inflict misery on the people of the Middle East to the extent that there's any resistance between these people that want to own the resources of that area and the actual ownership of it.
The confirmations of the U.S. approval and coordinations of Israeli attacks in Syria can definitely be seen as rather a public support for regime strikes in Syria, especially at a time when Israel has increased the intensity of its cross-border attacks. Such support would likely embolden the Israeli regime to carry out more attacks in Syria.
Turkey has targeted northern Iraq, killing several people and injuring a number of others. The strike hit the Sinjar Resisting Units, or YBS, a militia affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in Iraq's northern province of Sinjar. Turkey regards the PKK as a terrorist outfit. According to security sources, the strike hit a municipal council building in Sunni, a village near the border with Syria. Turkey regularly carries out airstrikes into northern Iraq and has sent commandos to support its offensives. Baghdad accuses Turkey of violating its sovereignty. Turkey has a long-running military campaign in northern Syria against Syrian Kurdish YPG militia. Ankara considers that group as a terrorist organization as well. Ankara is reportedly planning to expand its military operation in northern Syria. President Erdogan has told the parliament Ankara aims to resume its efforts to create a 30-kilometer safe zone along its border with Syria. He has also urged NATO member states to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria.
It is crazy to think that the Turks will be fighting American-sponsored Kurds, and there isn't anybody in the world community that can call them up on the hypocrisy and say, you are fighting amongst yourselves in a way that could end up in a world war.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the international community not to work with Erdogan on the lands of other countries to achieve goals that will have catastrophic effects on security, peace, and stability in the region and in the world. Russia also considers Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise as it could escalate and destabilize the situation. Iran also voiced concern about the planned operation, saying the move could complicate the situation even further. In Syria, Turkey conducted three military operations in 2016, 2018, and 2019 that specifically aimed to prevent the formation of politically autonomous regions along the Turkish border controlled by Kurdish-dominated YPG militants. A fourth operation in 2020 in the Idlib region did not specifically target PKK affiliates, but it was in line with Turkey's desire to maintain territorial control and create a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border.
But it's a big problem. It shows Turkey up for what it is, and that Turkey is doing everything in the region purely for their own short-term benefit, and they are quite happy to fight the Kurds and crush the Kurds, and this completely conflicts with the American. Well, the Americans aren't really trying to help the Kurds, as they aren't ever really trying to help anyone apart from themselves. And their short-term allies, the Kurds, are going to end up fighting their other allies, the Turks.
Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. After Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push YPG fighters away from border areas. Turkey has played a major role in supporting terrorists in Syria ever since a major foreign-backed insurgency overtook the country more than 10 years ago. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other senior officials have said the Damascus government will respond through all legitimate means available to the ongoing ground offensive by Turkish forces and allied Takfiri militants in the northern part of the war-battered Arab country.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee, and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kadhim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture. And it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: اجعلوا لأنفسكم حظا من الدنيا بإعطائها ما تشتهي من الحلال وما لا يثلم المروة وما لا سرف فيه، واستعينوا بذلك على أمور الدين، فإنه روي: ليس منا من ترك دنياه لدينه أو ترك دينه لدنياه.
Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated, "Allocate for yourselves a portion of the world by taking from it that which is lawful of what you desire, and that which does not breach the honorable virtues, and that wherein there is no extravagance. And in this way, use it to assist and improve the matters of religion. For it has been narrated that the one who abandons their worldly affairs for their religion is not from us, and neither is the one who abandons their religion for their worldly affairs."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and these excellent dialogues of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence talked about certain subjects, of course, ranging from morals to ethics to akhlaq to spirituality to human rights to the rights of human beings with Allah and the rights to human beings with one another, and etc. In one such instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was speaking with one of his companions, and in this dialogue, they were talking about injustice. It is interesting, but it seems that the companion was talking about what injustice is and what injustice is like. But Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam responded and said something quite interesting. He said that whoever suffers injustice knows its severity. Now, of course, it makes sense because as onlookers to what is happening across the world and what is happening in the globe, it is very easy for us to say that, for example, the Palestinian people are under oppression and injustice, or the Yemeni people are under oppression and injustice, or, for example, the Muslims in India or the Muslims in Sweden where the Holy Quran is being burnt. These Muslims are under injustice and they are suffering oppression. But here it's interesting that saying that there is oppression and injustice going on, we really don't feel in our depth and in our souls and in our hearts, we don't really understand what that injustice is like. Truly, as Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, that whoever suffers actually goes through that oppression and actually goes through that injustice, that person really knows its severity. And so for us who are merely onlookers or who merely speak about these things or make people aware about the injustice that is going on across the world, we too must feel that truly, we don't understand what it is like to be those kind of people, meaning that which they are going through is much more painful than what we can imagine. And so this in itself helps us to be able to relate to them, and it helps us to relate to the pain and injustice that they are going through, even though it is on a small level and on a small to a small extent and a lesser extent, but still it helps us to be able to understand that what these people are suffering is much worse than what we understand it to be. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imama of Imam Al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. Another problem we see happening at the time is, you've heard of the movement or the Ismaili school of thought, the Shahada of Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayh, which was after the establishment of the government of the Abbasids, while it was not still as strong as it was, except for the last few years, Abu Ja'far al-Mansur strengthened the foundations of the Abbasid government, but even that was not as strong as afterwards, after Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, but he was the first strongest ruler of the Abbasids. That was the last few years of the life of Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayh. Seeing that they wanted to overthrow the government of the Umayyads and establish a government that is just, losing sight of the most critical and central point regarding governance, and that is the person who rules, losing sight of that caused some of the companions of the Ahlul Bayt to break off, to create splinter groups that fought against status quo, but not under the Imam any longer. They broke off. They started going towards others.
Thank Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Joe Biden's upcoming trip to Palestine in July will serve as yet another message to the Palestinian people that the Israeli regime is working hand in hand with the U.S., says Mitchell Plitnik, author, in an article published under the heading, Biden administration continues to disregard the Palestinian people. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. When Joe Biden won the 2020 election, little was expected of him regarding the struggle for Palestinian rights. He had the advantage of replacing Donald Trump, who had surpassed his predecessors in supporting extreme Israeli regime goals, so he was bound to look good by comparison. Being better than Trump is an extremely low standard, and while Biden has met it, he has been better than Trump only by the thinnest of margins. In fact, Biden has managed to fail to meet even the lowest expectations he himself set. While he has not taken major steps in the Zionist regime's favor as Trump did, the day-to-day lives of Palestinians continue to deteriorate under his watch. His upcoming trip to the occupied Palestinian territories and the West Bank in July is unlikely to change that. The rhetoric coming out of the Biden administration has been as consistent as it has been empty. They have consistently stated that they support a two-state solution and they want to take steps to ensure equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and dignity to Palestinians. But the administration's actions directly belie that statement. The absence of any attempt even to seriously discuss Palestinian rights with the Zionist regime demonstrates that clearly. And the specific examples are too numerous to list. Recently, the United States rejected a Palestinian Authority request to restart peace talks based on the 1967 borders. That should comport with Biden administration policy, but they refused based on the precarious political situation in the occupied territories where the coalition government has lost key votes, is now in the minority and is fraying quickly. A Palestinian source told the Israeli regime daily, Haaretz, that they, meaning the Americans, talk as if only Israel has a cabinet and public opinion that has to be considered. What about Palestinian opinion? And what about the aggression against Palestinians? The American attitude about aggression toward Palestinians couldn't be clearer than it has been since the Zionist regime's killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghila. Despite at least four independent, fully transparent investigations by CNN, the Associated Press, Bellingcat, and most recently, the Washington Post, the Biden administration continues to call for an independent, transparent investigation, which is clearly code for an Israeli one. The Biden team has simply dismissed the eyewitness testimony of Palestinians who were with or near Shirin when she was killed, for no apparent reason aside from their being Palestinian. No doubt, Biden will, during his July visit to Beit Lahm, rebuff Palestinian inquiries about the killing and simply repeat to the Israelis that they want a transparent, independent investigation. Instead of addressing the apartheid conditions and daily severe human rights violations Palestinians are continuing to endure, the Biden administration tossed crumbs to the Palestinian Authority by, for example, upgrading the Palestinian Affairs Unit to the U.S. Office of Palestinian Affairs and having it report directly to the State Department rather than to the U.S. Embassy. Biden has made it clear that he will not take steps to undo the damage Trump did by moving the embassy to Al-Quds, nor will he revoke the United States' illegal recognition of the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. The administration is, on the other hand, laser-focused on expanding the Abraham Accords and plans to use this trip to move Saudi-Israeli regime relations forward toward normalization. Biden insisted that the planned meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who Biden once called a pariah, was not about energy prices, but this is an obvious lie. Biden will go to MBS, hat in hand, and plead for lower energy prices and cooperation with the fake regime of Israel. But the Saudi king Salman remains opposed to normalization with the Zionist regime outside the framework of the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, and the Saudis are already coordinating with the Zionist regime on security matters. So Biden is demeaning himself for what will likely be no reason. as OPEC has already announced plans to increase oil production in July and August, an increase which is likely to be reversed in time for the U.S. primary elections in November. Meanwhile, the Palestinian people face an ever-tightening occupation, yet one would see no indication of this in Washington. If Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken started their term reluctant to rock the Israeli boat, they're now terrified that anything they do that plays poorly in the occupied territories risks toppling the cabinet of Naftali Bennett and could lead to the return of Benjamin Netanyahu. With Democrats already poised to lose big in the midterms and Biden's popularity at historic lows, they don't want an Israeli regime prime minister who will actively work with Republicans to further diminish the Democrats' position. That means throwing the Palestinians even further under the bus. It means ignoring settlement expansion, the increasing violence of settlers and the Israeli troops and police, and congressional letters calling for the president to try to stop the mass evictions of Palestinians in Masafer Yatta. And it certainly means turning a blind eye to the ongoing apartheid. Biden's trip in July is not likely to do much for him or for the United States, but it will be yet another message to the Palestinian people that the Zionist regime is working hand in hand with the United States. And whether a Democrat or a Republican is in the White House, that isn't going to change.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, self-purification. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that human self, our self, needs purification and needs to be refined and purified. And this is a fact which is religiously, intellectually, and socially, it's a non-fact that our souls need purification. But there is a question here. Why our souls need purification? Is there any deficiency, any fault, anything wrong about our nature that we need purification? The nature and essence of humans, no doubt that it's pure. There is no impurity, there is no kind of fault and deficiency in our souls. We have no such an aspect in our personality or in our essence that needs to be changed. So we in our core are pure, are beautiful. And that's why Quran says that human has been created on ahsani taqweem, best formation. So our nature is pure and our nature is good. Our nature is on the best possible form. So why, in the first place, we need purification? Is there really any need of purification? And what are the causes? Is there a natural cause, a natural problem in our formation? Or it's we who are damaged and create problems in our own selves, and that's why we need to purify ourselves. So it is a problem of, is it a problem of nature or is it a problem of our own bad decisions? So this is the point which we consider and think about. Welcome back. This is A to Z. We were talking about self-purification. Yes, so there was a question, and that why we need purification in the first place. Is there any fault in our nature? We answered that there is no fault in our nature. Actually, we are purified and clear, and we have no fault in our basic nature. It's actually our own bad decisions which gradually develop bad habits in our personality. We get used to wrong things. The negativity which we create with our own actions needs to be purified. In our intellectual aspects, the wrong ideas, the wrong beliefs, in our psychological aspect, where there are bad habits and bad qualities which we develop with our own wrong decisions, they eventually end to a personality with bad habits and wrong qualities and vices that needs to be purified. And that purification means gradually clearing our own inner self from that negativity, that wrong actions, that bad habits, that negative aspects of our character, which are developed by our own bad decisions. So have you seen a garden without a gardener who does not care about the plants and flowers and herbs? With the passage of time, it becomes messy and the weak plants die and the stronger one takes a more and more place in the garden and it becomes messy. And that's the point where a refinement, correction needs when there is a corruption. Likewise, in ourselves, when we leave ourselves for emotions and passions to work, gradually we need purification. So it's because of our own decision. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala enable us to purify ourselves and clear ourselves from every impurity. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
The fiancé of slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi said on Sunday, 19th of June, that she was very disappointed in President Joe Biden's plan to meet with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who the United States has determined ordered the operation that killed Khashoggi in 2018. The article you're about to hear has been written by ABC News journalist Ben Gittleson. The piece is titled, Slain Journalist Fiancé Slams Biden for Plan to Visit Saudi Arabia. Fiancé of slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi said on Sunday, 19th of June, that she was very disappointed in President Joe Biden's plan to meet with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who the United States has determined ordered the operation that killed Khashoggi in 2018. Mr. Biden, you'll soon visit Saudi Arabia as president. Well, you'll meet with Jamal's heartless executor, dishonoring yourself and Jamal. By meeting Mohammed bin Salman, said Hatice Cengiz, in a video message posted by Democracy for the Arab World Now, a non-profit organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Hatice Cengiz asked Biden to press for more answers in the death of her fiancé when he meets with Mohammed bin Salman during a visit to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, next month. If you have to put oil over the principles and expediency over values, she says, can you at least ask where is Jamal's body? Doesn't he deserve a proper burial? And what happened to his killers? She implored. As a candidate, Joe Biden once pledged to make Saudi Arabia a pariah over its human rights abuses. Soon after he took office last year, his administration released a U.S. intelligence report that assessed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had ordered the operation that resulted in Jamal Khashoggi's murder in Istanbul, Turkey. Dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist who lived in Virginia. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told ABC News that she could not say whether President Biden would specifically ask the questions raised by Hatice Cengiz, but said the president was a straight shooter. I cannot read out right now or lay out what the agenda is going to be or what the conversations are going to be, she said. But I can assure you that when it comes to human rights, this is something that is a priority for this president. Karine Jean-Pierre said, just hearing Cengiz's comments was devastating. Clearly, our hearts go out to her and her pain that she's currently going through, Jean-Pierre said. Hatice Cengiz's comments come in the wake of the White House's announcement that President Biden will visit Saudi Arabia in July. The anticipated trip has drawn ire for the potential message a diplomatic trip could send to a country accused of involvement in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, as well as numerous human rights violations. But President Biden is also struggling to rein in sky-high inflation and rising gas prices, a political liability. Saudi Arabia, a major oil producer, chairs the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council grouping of oil-producing Arab nations. Saudi Arabia and the Biden administration have both said energy security will be part of discussions during President Biden's visit. Hatice Cengiz also made a personal appeal to Joe Biden. President Biden, I know you have experienced the unimaginable pain of losing a loved one, she said. Cengiz also tweeted on Sunday that she was very disappointed to hear about Biden's Saudi Arabia travel plans. A U.S. resident was murdered for defending democracy and human rights in the country, and now Biden is legitimizing this action, she wrote. Hatice Cengiz recently criticized professional golfers for joining LIV Golf, the Saudi Arabian-backed competition that's drawn some of the biggest names in golf to the league. If they still carry on and play as if everything is normal, then they should be banned from playing in the world's major tournaments, she said in an email, according to a report by USA Today Sports. The White House has said President Biden plans to discuss a range of bilateral, regional and global issues in Saudi Arabia, including the war in Yemen.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Today, arrogant France grandeur is broken and nations talk against the US. February 17, 2022. My recommendation to our dear youth is to see today in which line the enemy is moving, what the enemy is aiming, and then to act and move in the opposite direction. In my opinion, the way I see things, the enemy has targeted the nation, public opinion, and the minds of the young people. They are spending billions of dollars in their think tanks, as they themselves put it, think tank and research circles, trying to turn the Iranian nation, and especially the youth, from this path. And they are currently doing so in two ways. One is through economic pressures in order to make things very difficult for the people and separate them from the Islamic Republic. And another is mudslinging, telling lies, slandering and making accusation against the main personalities and centers that have been influential in the progress of the revolution. One day they level accusations at the Islamic Consultative Majlis, one day they level accusations at the Guardian Council, and another day, they accuse the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Today, it is the Guards Corps' turn. They slander the Guards Corps and our great and outstanding martyrs, Shahid Soleimani. If they were not afraid of the people's rage and reaction, they would also insult Imam. However, they do not dare do and know that the reaction of the people is sharp against this. Therefore, these two means are at the disposal of the enemy to separate the people from the system and to tamper with the minds of the people.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The enemy has taken these two steps. Economic pressure, one of which is sanctions and the like, and mudslinging and telling lies via their media. This means economic and media enmity. The youth must stand up against this. The Iranian nation must stand against these two moves. The economic pressures must be neutralized by internal efforts. The neutralization of the sanctions and, of course, by diplomatic efforts. Our good brothers are busy working. Our revolutionary brothers are also working to lift the sanctions and persuade the other side, which is good. But the main task is to neutralize the sanctions by creating a movement of domestic production and domestic economic mobilization. Knowledge-based companies are very important. The move to establish knowledge-based economy and knowledge-based companies is really important. But this must be developed and expanded. This is one measure, and other measures is to foil the media and mudslinging move of the enemy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day.
No, no, no.
Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up, and the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike.
Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike. Trains, trams, metros and buses are not operating. All of the departing flights from the main airports in Zaventem and Charleroi have been cancelled, impacting an enormous number of passengers, including would-be holidaymakers.
Western nations are sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro. Those on strike insist there is too much emphasis on war and not enough on diplomatic negotiations.
There is a NATO rule which says that each country has to invest 2% of their budget on military stuff. I think this is completely useless.
They have money to send to Ukraine for sophisticated weapons. It will cost a lot. And they say they don't have enough money to support us.
All of them, they just have blood on their hands. I think that's the real problem. And high society who is just making profit of all of that.
Unions in Belgium are warning of more strikes during the summer if the national government and EU authorities fail to ease cost of living pressures. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Day one of a three-day strike that's made London's underground network grind to a crawl. Stations normally teeming with people, either closed or offering only a skeletal service. The advice from the authorities, take the bus. And that has meant scenes like this. Prime Minister Boris Johnson criticized the biggest strike in Britain in a generation as an unnecessary aggravation.
I want to emphasize to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong, and so unnecessary.
An inconvenience it may be, but the unions say the government left them no choice.
Some of our members have not had a pay rise for the third anniversary now. We can resolve that if we've got a proper negotiating framework. But the fact is that Grant Shapps, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson are dictating the terms of this dispute. Now, they can either facilitate a settlement or they can block one. At the moment, they're blocking one.
And all this, of course, comes with a cost to the City of London and to the people.
The London Chamber of Commerce says the cost of a strike like this to London's economy is tens of millions of dollars a day. But perhaps the biggest impact the strike is having is the headache it's causing to the nearly 5 million commuters who use the underground to get from A to B on a daily basis.
I think, you know, it's holding people to ransom.
I would say major inconvenience.
I support the workers getting the right pay they need, and obviously they work really hard. But it's hard not to get annoyed when your journey time is double.
As a teacher, as someone who's just graduating into a profession where there has not been a real terms pay rise in 9 years, I look to the rail workers and I look to the RMT as a beacon of hope.
The strike has shown how dependent London is on its underground network and how powerful unions are. Negotiations for a compromise are ongoing, and so are the strikes. And it doesn't stop with the rail workers. Other professions, such as teaching and healthcare, are also considering industrial action in the UK's summer of unrest. Saeed Purza, London.
Afghanistan, the axis of regional stability and cooperation is the title of this seminar that hosts political figures and experts from Afghanistan and neighboring countries. The event aims to discuss ways Afghanistan and neighboring countries can boost peace and integration in the region.
Afghanistan has experienced almost 4 decades of war, conflict, and invasion. But with recent political changes, the country is opening a new chapter in its history. Therefore, Afghanistan's priorities, policy, and engagement must be reviewed. Our relations with neighbors is one of these elements of regional stability and development. New Afghan rulers must boost ties and dialogues with regional states to prevent the foreign powers from another interference and invasion.
Representatives from neighboring countries also announced their readiness for providing needed assistance for the Afghan nation, stressing the need for lasting peace in Afghanistan.
Iran and Afghanistan have had long bilateral relations in different areas, especially in the health sector. Iran has helped the Afghan nation with establishing clinics and hospitals across Afghanistan, as well as providing medicines. Iran is also training Afghan doctors and health staff inside Afghanistan or giving them scholarships for Iranian universities.
In the meantime, Taliban leaders attending the seminar say that Afghanistan is strongly in favor of promoting regional cooperation in different fields.
The Islamic Emirate is committed to establish positive and fair relations with regional countries, especially our neighbors. In return, we expect the world and regional countries to help Afghans and Afghanistan. Talking about potential cooperation opportunities, I should say that Afghanistan is a bridge in the region. If they assist us, we can establish air corridors or construct streets and railways to help promote regional trade.
The Taliban-led interim government has not yet been recognized by world countries, but the neighbors of Afghanistan have held several meetings to emphasize the need for stability in Afghanistan and helping Afghan people. After decades of war, Afghanistan is stepping into a new era, gearing up for regional integration and cooperation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
French President Emmanuel Macron's coalition has been reprimanded at the ballot box in the second round legislative vote, failing to secure an absolute majority. However, he and the longtime Conservative Party are expected to continue to unite on neoliberal policies, and combined, they will control over half of parliament, with initial projections giving them 53%.
This is a country which is difficult to govern, with a lot of different demands. I don't see there being a big change for the average person over the next 5 years, but I do foresee a lot of difficulties.
In his first term, Macron routinely forced policies through by executive decree, even though he had a comfortable absolute majority, causing many to see the legislative vote as an empty formality. Thus, turnout reached just 46%, making abstention the real Democratic majority winner.
Voter participation was far from excellent, unfortunately. Hopefully it won't hurt the credibility of the government when it comes to implementing reform.
The biggest winner was the far-right National Front, who more than doubled most poll predictions with around 90 seats, making them the third largest power in parliament and tripling their best score ever. When the results were announced, their election headquarters immediately chanted, "Macron resign," and they will likely play an unpredictable role in mainstream politics. The left-wing NUPES, Popular Front Alliance, promised much